So it's a little convoluted, but it really does work, and it's the best way that I've found to get around coup headers.
Go hack on things you're not supposed to.
Yeah, well,
go find access pass on third parties.
Leverage the third party trust relationship. Alrighty, y'all, I've been telling you for the past couple of weeks about Threat Locker Detect, right? Bunch of cool logging, a bunch of cool remediation methods that they have built in right into that automation in the Threat Locker Detect system. But at the end of the day, there's nothing quite like having a human in the loop for these sort of incidents. And back when I was a consultant, you know, one of the techniques that we would use pretty often was if we had a team that was pretty active in incident response, like they were fighting us as we were trying to get into the systems, we would just switch to nights because nobody feels like getting their butt out of bed and going to the computer and fighting off the red teamer, right, in the middle of the night. And so that worked a lot of the time, but Threat Locker's got your back in a situation just like this as well, because they've got a product, an add-on for their Threat Locker Detect system called Cyber Hero Managed Detect and Response. And this employs a 24/7 monitoring service of cyber heroes that are there to fight off attackers in your network, which one, sounds hella intimidating, and two, makes sense that you would want a human in the loop there. Yeah, what a lot of people don't realize too is there's time zones, right? So it could be the middle of the day for someone in Asia, it could be middle of the night here, you know, in the US. So it's really important to have someone 24/7 kind of working on those systems to defend it. And Threat Locker has got your back with that, with their MDR product. All right, cool. Let's go back to the show. All right, my dude, first day of full-time bug bounty and freedom from the 9 to 5. How are you feeling?
I feel good. Yeah. And we got to announce that I'm the new co-host today, which is pretty sick.
Yeah.
Got to post that everywhere and it's popping off, but no, I'm excited to be here. I mean, I hope that I can pull off the goal of finding a bug today on day one. Obviously, you pulled me away from the computer for a little while here today, but it's worth it. So.
Yeah, man. Dude, I don't know what's up this morning, but my shoulder is like hecked up from volleyball. Last night, dude, was like some of the best volleyball I've ever played. Like the rest of our team wasn't there. So we were actually 5 versus 6. Yeah. And there's something about being like 5 versus 6 that just makes you kind of go into overdrive mode. You know what I'm saying?
Is it like an actual match, like 1v1 where you advance or you get a win, loss and everything?
Yeah, we played like 3 rounds, like 3 games to 25, and then we do it again. So nice. It's like 6 games in total, and it just contributes to your overall score. But dude, yesterday I was just crushing the spikes, and it just, my arm's feeling it a little bit today though.
Yeah, I was looking around on the ground because I was thinking about the Nido. We found out that both you and I like our Nido as our little fidget thing, because you were using it in the last episode.
I freaking love this thing, dude. I'm like, I think I got one and literally like I saw it and I'm like, oh my gosh, this thing is amazing. I started playing with it. I never gave it back to her.
Same. Yeah. So same thing.
They got me like 6 for Christmas. So
that's amazing. I don't know what it is about it. Like, it's definitely a really unique feel. I'm sure, honestly, we already know a lot of our listeners have either ADHD or some form of autism. If you need a fidget thing, it's called Nido. It's really interesting. It definitely feels like cooler and better than any kind of other squish toy.
It's also pretty freaking good for just like, a hand exercise too. It'll rip up your forearms.
I kind of want to do that for getting better grips in BJJ. I was already thinking about that if I just do it enough, but anyways.
Dude, I rolled for the first time in like a couple months, like 2 weeks ago. And it just so reinvigorated. I gotta get out there. I gotta get in the gym for that, dude.
It's locked behind my quarterly goal along with playing video games and watching more YouTube. So when I hit my quarterly bug bounty goal, it unlocks all of those things.
Well, I liked what who was it? Was it Douglas? What Douglas said is like, you know, offsetting your goal with your like professional goal with like a no, that was James Kettle. James Kettle posted about it. He said
you should have
like a professional goal and then a non-professional goal that you kind of pair. So he's like, I want to like get my research in DEF CON or whatever. And I also want to like do a 3x body weight deadlift. I'm like, oh shit, dude. Like a 3x body weight deadlift is like pretty freaking good.
It's pretty intense. Yeah. I've always had really strong legs. for me, I would I'd maybe try to do a 3x body weight or maybe 2.5x body weight squat or something. But
oh my God, dude, are you serious?
I don't know if I could, but I think it'd be interesting to try. Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, deadlift is definitely better for me. My legs are a little weak, but the back kind of makes up for it. So
yeah, nice.
Anyway, all right. So we did a little off track. Banter. Right in the beginning. We got some news today, a little bit of stuff from me, a little bit of stuff from you, and then we're going to talk about web header stuff, which, it seems like you're very prepared on, Joseph.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a little bit, but I'm going to play as a listener maybe, so we'll see.
Okay. We Joseph is new to the co-host thing, and we had the doc sectioned out, and he like did all of his thorough research on the news section, and then I was like, so what do you think of the web header section? And he's like, the who what section. So
I will say, listen, I've been a guest on Critical Thinking. I prepped for one or two episodes, and in every one, all of the stuff's in the news section. It's all just been right there. There's been no main content. So
all good, man. It happens. Plus, you know, I'm used to just yapping about client side stuff. So I get it. All right. Let me hit the first news item then. This was just a really like feel good story that I saw. This is from I grabbed this one actually from LinkedIn from Dustin Kirkland, and he posted about an article entitled "A Proud Dad's Tale of Two Bug Hunting Daughters and Their Responsible Disclosure." And when I saw this dude, I was like, "Oh, my heart is so warmed." And I was reading through here, and his daughters found two bugs on the like parental controls aspect of Google. One was like a you could reuse those like codes that you give to the child to unlock the device.
Yeah.
And then the other one was like on their like Chromecast or Google TV, they just mashed the home button and they bypassed the parental controls. It just put them right into the parent account, which is like totally nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. When you sent me that and I clicked on it, first of all, the picture, the header picture is like so cute. So hopefully people either tune into the YouTube channel and we have our producer add that in there or they go to the blog post. But yeah, I mean, obviously we have young kids, both you and I, and so it just warms the heart. But yeah, totally impressive. I mean, and they both got paid. Like no better way to set them up for financial success from throwing that into the Roth IRA as like an 8-year-old.
Oh yeah, and then for sure. And then what it like, I want to say down here at the end, where did she say? She said
it was the first daughter. Like, yeah.
Oh, was it the first daughter that was like, I want to invest it in the stock market. Yeah. She says, I asked her, what did she want to do with it? And she says, invest it in the stock market, dad. And I'm just like, could you imagine?
They're raising them well. That's for sure.
So cute, man. So cute. And yeah, I think it's really cool to share the hacking stuff with your kids. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that I've hacked with my kid and, it's been a nice experience. At least to just be able to talk about like, yeah, I know a little bit about hacking, you know, even if it's not your thing, it's still cool to be able to say like, yeah, I understand what my dad does and can talk about it a little bit and say they have some experience with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So with my oldest daughter, she's 8, but I think it was probably when she was 7, she told me that at school to log into some app they or some website they use, they type in their classroom's number, like either their classroom number or their teacher's name or something. But yeah, she told me that instead she typed in they type in their classroom number, but instead she typed in our phone number, and there wasn't even enough digits for it. It was like 6 digits instead of 8 or 10 or whatever phone numbers are. And it brought up a somewhat like a different class, and she could see other students' information in there. And when she got home and told me this, I like just lit up. I was so pumped and told her that she had found her first bug and made a big deal out of it. And then whenever HackerOne had like the family kind of event in Orlando last January, they were down there and she was going around telling all the other bug hunters and telling all the staff about the bug she found. I would have her retell the stories though.
Dude, that's so cute, man. Yeah, those kid-oriented apps are like wicked insecure sometimes. And I get it, because you got to like make it easy enough for like a kid to be able to log in and stuff like that. But like, also, why don't you just not put all the kids' PII at risk?
Exactly. When it's school related, it's
And I guess like, I don't know, if you're like a motivated attacker trying to go after kids or something like that, maybe you could figure it out. But most of the time you're not even going to see it unless you've got a kid and you're like, oh yeah, they're logging into this portal or whatever. So I don't know, but it's definitely a little bit insecure. I have to say most of those kid oriented apps that I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, all the different stuff for like kids sports and for like their fundraisers and all those. I mean, I've probably put our information in, I don't know, 20 different sites that I'm obscene terrified
amount of apps.
that are like very vulnerable, very insecure. But
solid, dude. All right, what have you got on your side? You just want to talk about H1 and BC pen tests?
Yeah. So I put down on this news list just for the listeners, because I actually haven't heard you or Joel mention it too much. It might have been mentioned in passing, but both HackerOne and BugCrowd have a notion of pen test. They've kind of iterated and changed through the years. HackerOne pen tests are pretty cool. They're like in standard and then premium. You don't get paid for findings on those. I remember there were some on BugCrowd in the past. I don't know if it still works this way, where you could get paid a flat fee and then you also got paid for the vulnerabilities, which is pretty cool. And that's how, and I guess just, as an addendum to that, not only are there HackerOne and BugCrowd pen tests, but also Google will sometimes do research grants where it's similar. You get paid a flat fee, but you still get paid for all of the bugs that you submit. And you have to go in and enable that on your profile. So if anybody has is interested in that, go to your Google Bug Hunters profile and make sure you enable it, that you're open to it.
Yeah. And so you have to like go in there on bughunters.google.com, go to your profile, scroll down. And I think there's like a little toggle button that says like enable research grants. And I'm like, dang, that should be public, man. Like, or that should be on by default. Like that would be great if people just all of a sudden like, boom, here's some money in your bank. Now go hack on this.
Exactly. You do have to go and accept it and all that. So
there's also some, I'm trying to remember who told me about it. It was another top hacker recently told me that they were doing some pen tests. I want to say it's with Integrity. I don't know. Yeah. But it was $500 flat and you get paid for the bugs.
Right.
And I'm like, that's super cool. And you know, anybody who's done these pen tests before, it's like, I don't know, man, pen tests are such a different world than bug bounty. It's like, there's just bugs freaking everywhere.
Very frequently, especially if it's one of their first few.
Yeah, exactly. And so, to be honest, I think I'd be a little bit more in favor of like the flat rate plus bounties rather than just the, you know, higher flat rate. So,
yeah. And I think a lot of it depends on like the hours that are expected there. You know, if it's kind of like, make sure you've tested everything, you know, with like a baseline pass, that's much more reasonable than like a, you know, a kind of lowish rate for a bunch of hours. So.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, dude, I've really enjoyed the Google one too. Like you and I both got some research grants with Google lately and they've just been really great. It's just, they're so fun to work with, dude, to be honest. Like, because they will help you exploit bugs. Really, really nice. Really good.
Yeah, very communicative. Yeah, very easy to work with. Yeah.
All right, let me jump over to my next news item, which was TruffleSec released a new article talking about OAuth bugs that affect millions of accounts, particularly Google's OAuth login. And I was clicking through here because I've been really interested in OAuth lately. And we're going to do an episode on OAuth in a couple weeks after this episode airs. But this one was interesting. He does kind of break down the specific details of it, but the TLDR of it is kind of like, if a startup fails, you can register the domain and then SSO into all these services,
there's totally lots of other makes ways sense. Too. Not necessarily always failing. It could be they changed their domain, like they bought a new one, they migrated. There's lots of maybe other use cases or other examples there.
Yeah. I think the coolest part about this piece of research was the proposed fix that they had that where they were talking about implementing two immutable identifiers in the OpenID Connect flow. And I think Google is considering this. They said at the end of the day, they awarded a $1,337 bounty and then seems like they'll be making some changes. Yeah. So I think that's cool. But I think this really also makes me think of the episode with like the top bugs from 2024 from the hackers. Nogli mentioned on that episode that they used a dev token to get into an Azure environment. Mm-hmm. And then once they were in the Azure environment, they dumped all the users and then looked at all the domains that were registerable. Dude, I swear, sometimes like majde ego ga shinu. My English just dies, dude. But yeah, they looked for all the domains that were registerable and then registered one and then used that to escalate their privileges. So I think that whole, I don't know, man. I don't know what I think about that concept because I think it goes a little bit outside the realm of like normal bug bounty flow. Mm-hmm. But man, the impact is high a lot of times. So
yeah.
I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it stood out to me that this is often not, I mean, companies where this would be impactful are already defunct, right?
Exactly. So
like, who's gonna pay you for this?
Well,
but at the same time, there is impact there because like they mentioned this thing, you know, millions of people's data is accessible through these third-party SaaS providers. Honestly, it's a little bit of like a SaaS security, or I guess maybe cloud security issue, right? Because with the single sign-on, once you get access to the account, you can get access to everything else. And yeah, I really loved that part of Nagli's book. And it actually makes me wonder, but also probably believe that other username disclosures might actually have slightly more impact if there's something like this possible. So
And I think the way that this would apply to bug bounty is like you said, you know, the companies that are being like attacked here are mostly what they're talking about here is personal user information and the information that are in those systems, right? But I think that it's most applicable in the way that Nagli did it, right? Which is you have XYZ company that you're attacking, right? And XYZ company contracts out to ABC company. ABC company goes under, right? You grab the domain and then single sign on into like some part of XYZ company, the first company, and then get access to like their internal Slack or their Jira or whatever. But to be able to get that level of insight, one, you have to know what companies this company is contracting with, right? And then you've also got to understand, you know, what systems that contracting company will have access to on your target company. So there's a lot of recon, the pretty heavy recon that needs to go into place there, but I could definitely see this being super useful for those targets where it's like, hey, get this, you know, get this flag that's in this like deep embedded system. We don't care how you do it. As long as you get the flag, you get the money. And then you kind of go through this route.
Especially if they're using some sort of like if they're using Okta or something, there's no doubt there are lots of non-employee accounts in there. Whereas when you think about something like Google Workspace, I think like every user is going to definitely have the exact same, you know, domain name as a part of their email address. But then there are lots of systems like Azure or Okta or whatever, where there are going to be a lot of guest users, like you said, contractors that have different domain names at the end, and then they can actually log in. And those, if those expire, then of course you could hijack them. So,
yeah, it's a little interesting. I wonder, I'm looking at all this now and I'm wondering, let's say for example, we have a company domain.com that went, you know, unregistered, right? And we take over an account on there. Is there any way for us to see what users they had in that Google Suite organization in the past? Because if there was, then you'd have a much easier time saying like, okay, I'm just going to register all of the users that belong to this company and then try to use all of those users to log into all of these systems, right? And you got sort of like a many to many sort
of
thing.
Could you do like a wildcard? I'm pretty sure there's some way to set up like wildcard email stuff where you receive everything that comes to anyone. And so then you would be able to slowly know who was there because they probably register for websites and they're going to get like spam or marketing material. So you would be able to see who they go to.
That's a great idea. Yeah. And then you'll see, okay, you know, Slack got an update or something like that. And you're like, that's a great idea. I like that. Huh. Dang it, dude. We got to release this on the podcast.
We have a week to go look it up now. So.
We got to start recording further in advance. Good shit, dude.
Yeah. I'll just DM you.
All good. All right. What you got next on your list?
So let me pull back up the show notes. So I tweeted something. Just literally one sentence. So most of you probably saw it on your Twitter because for some reason it resonated with a ton of people. I just tweeted that AI agent security is a massive industry that's being slept on.
Yeah.
And it blew up. Yeah. I got 118,000 views and already has 1,000 likes and 400 bookmarks. And it's similar to, I think, like it resonated with people in the same way that I wrote a blog post early last year, like February of last year, about the required security architecture changes to make AI agents secure. And specifically, you know, I got into the details of like, I think we need it to be like delegated or childlike system, because when there's a human in the loop, if the AI wants to pay somebody, like you don't want it just throwing your money out the window, right? You want to be able to approve it. Or if it wants to send an email or read emails, potentially like sensitive ones, then we need some sort of like way to approve that. And then I also think we need some like really smart people working on the architecture side of things, like similar to like how Apple Cloud or Apple AI Cloud, they released that extremely in-depth architecture and they open sourced it so people could critique it because they want it to be secure. I think, you know, when agents are executing code and stuff, the sandboxes have to be like locked tight, especially as they potentially get really, really intelligent, and we need like AI safety controls there too. And so in general, I think there's going to be like an auth layer, like an auth Z layer, where it's like, you know, just because this AI can use the browser, should they be able to send requests to gmail.com, or should they be able to, like, I almost wonder, I was thinking about this. This is like some big alpha. I think there's a potential solution there at the DNS level. So like, I think that you could potentially have like almost, firewall like restrictions or just like a specific, you know, AI agent safe DNS support from Cloudflare or something where it's like at 3.3.5.5 or something.
And
like that's specifically for sandboxes that AIs are interacting in that won't let them do certain stuff. But anyways, I don't know. But my whole point in bringing this up for the podcast is we've got a lot of really smart listeners that are extremely intelligent, and I think they should lean into the niche of if they're interested in it. How am I going to hack AI agents in the future? Because there's going to be a bunch of new companies that are going to get bug bounty programs that are offering AI agent type support. How can I hack on my existing programs, which are already implementing AI agents on the backside? Like what kind of bug could be there? And then if people like building stuff, like how can I build some sort of like AI agent security product, whether it's that auth layer or other stuff? So I just wanted to bring that up because I think it's blowing up in the industry and it's on people's mind.
There's a lot of that, man. Yeah, for sure. And it's definitely like we were talking about before the episode ran, you know, I think it's a space where it's a very good niche. You know, if you are looking for an area where you want to specialize in hacking stuff, and you just want to make good money on that, you want to be a high paid consultant, that sort of thing, or you know, there's an episode that I'm thinking about doing, which I won't, you know, give away too much on, but essentially it's an episode around like what I call the AJX Chapman method, which is you like deep specialize on one specific thing.
Yep.
And how do you do that? And what areas would be a good place to specialize? Mm-hmm. I think this makes the list, you know, because whenever you see weaponized agents, you know, agents that have functionality to them that are of the ability to take action, you know, that's a specialized technology that you have to know how to attack. So I mean, let me ask you this, dude. What do you think are like, okay, let me just draw the correlation back to the AJX Chapman sort of thing, right? You know, people hit Alex Chapman up when they see a headless browser.
Yep, headless browser, XSSRC, you got to get it.
Exactly. Yep. You get that sort of headless browser type environment. So what is the user agent Chrome, right, of these AI agent things? What are the things that you should see that make you say, okay, hey, I should get this to an expert, or I should deep dive on this because there's more functionality here that I need to know how to attack at like a deeper level.
Yeah.
Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it does. That's basically the question I was asking Johan in that episode, if people want to go back and listen to that. Yeah. But like in general, it's just like, if it can do anything interesting with data or tools, that's what I find super interesting. And I think that level of functionality is a target rich environment because it is kind of annoying to hack sometimes because you have to convince the system to use the payload you want to use.
Super freaking annoying, yeah.
But also PortSpeaker's labs on that are really good, right? It's like you're telling an agent to call a tool with a payload and you can tell it to use a apostrophe or you can tell it to use open and close square brackets. You can tell it to like use other users' IDs, right? There's like there's kind of a rich attack surface there. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a strong niche, even if you don't like interacting with LLMs. Like, I don't want everyone to think like, oh, you know, I don't want to be the LLM hacker guy. And LLMs can be annoying because of the non-determinism there. But I think in this AI agent security space, we need people who are like working on like kind of the sandbox and like the sandbox escapes. We need people who are like tackling the prompt injection and jailbreak side of things. We need people who are like thinking through the AI safety thing. So I think that there's a lot of different areas you can specialize in. But yeah, in general, I would say, if there's a chatbot or an AI feature that has like a lot of tools or like some interesting or deep tools, and if the tools have access to any kind of data, like you just when you're chatting with chatbots, ask like, hey, what do you know about me? What can you tell me about myself? Because if it has a lot of information about you, then someone could leak that probably about you with certain different techniques.
Mm. There was a challenge we were given by a target recently, and I think the way that they outlined what they were looking for with these AI attacks was super good.
Yeah.
They were like, hey, you know, it needs to start with some sort of indirect prompt injection. So there has to be some tool that is grabbing your data as the attacker and then putting it into the prompt, right? So, you know, then they've got an array of tools that they can do that with. And then from there, you need to establish control of the LLM prompt, right? And then once you've established control of the LLM prompt, you need to either
get
do X, Y, Z, right? You either get persistence on the system, you affect the user's data in a negative way, in a way that's not undoable, you know, that causes permanent data loss or permanent data effect.
Or leak their data.
Yeah, or leak the data back out, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's a good like just quick and easy 3-step process, right? Establish some reasonable method for prompt injection, right? Yep. You know, indirect prompt injection or prompt injection. Establish control of the prompt, mm-hmm. right? And you know, gain control of the LLM, and then utilize that control to either leak or affect user data or yep. gain persistence in the LLM moving
yep.
forward.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, good stuff.
Pretty solid. Okay, cool. So dude, let me hop into this next dude. Now I'm all hype on AI stuff. Now I gotta change well actually, dude, since we're talking about AI stuff, what is this yep. rank thing that you had from Bishop Fox?
Yeah, so I'm sure most people know of Knoperator. I mm-hmm. found out before the episode that you're also friends Boy. With him in real life, which is cool.
Dude, he rocks, man.
But so yeah, he wrote this thing you all can find in the show notes. It's called Rank, but spelled with an I, so it's AI with mm-hmm. in the middle of the word rank. And so one thing you often want to do when you're hacking in general, it's like, what asset should I look at first, right? Which domain is most interesting? Which payload is most likely to work? They're like, humans kind of figure out, you know, what we're going to do first by kind of ranking them in our head and then just like going down that list. With AI, mm-hmm. sometimes that's hard to get them to like, that's not hard to get them to. You can just ask them to list them, but it's hard to get AI output to be ranked in a meaningful way based on a yeah. specific heuristic that you want and to not repeat itself and that sort of thing. And so they found some cool ways to, I haven't dug into how all of the different ways they use them, but they wrote an open source project where you can have AI rank a list of anything. And so I think for the security implications, they are pretty cool. The ones I just mentioned, you know, ranking the best payload we use or the most likely to use or the website that's most likely to be vulnerable, et cetera. There are probably a lot of different use cases here. But I think you went to the talk where they actually use this to find some bugs with called Patch yeah. Perfect, right?
Yeah, it was really cool when this showed up in my docs, because one, I'm like buddies with Caleb. He's like, I knew him even before the security community. We just met through yeah. a mutual friend. And then it was kind of crazy. I don't know if I've talked about this story on the pod before, but like I met him through a mutual friend, right? And my mutual friend was like, hey, you know, you're a hacker. He's a hacker. And I'm yeah. like, okay, cool. Yeah, sure. And then I meet him and he's like this super badass dude. Like, and so, cause like, there's so many people out there that are yeah. like, yeah, I'm a hacker. And they like, they work in security and it's like, you know, okay, cool. You know, you are a hacker, but it doesn't mean that you're doing like hands on the keyboard, you know, POC sure. or GTFO popping shit all day, every day sort of hacker. Right. That is definitely Caleb, you know?
Yeah.
And so like when I met him, I was like, oh shit, he's the real deal.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I, you know, we've got a local conference here in Richmond called RVASEC, and, you know, Caleb being the inspiration that he is, decides to support the local conference and present his talk there. Yeah. And so I was there, you know, just chilling, watching this talk, and, it was really good. It was entitled Patch Perfect, Harmonizing with LLMs to Find Security Vulns, which I loved, you know, cause mm-hmm. I'm a musical boy. Pitch Perfect.
Yeah. Pitch Perfect's a fantastic movie. You. We listened to that soundtrack for like years after it came out.
Freaking good, man. I'm like, I'm a little bit scared of that movie because if I watch it again, it's going to get all the earbugs and I'm just going to be singing nonstop for the yeah. past or for the foreseeable future. But the talk was really good in how they use sort of like this ranking sort of thing to identify the most likely functions in a binary diff of a patch
yeah.
that contain the vulnerability and cool. give the researcher that's trying to reverse a patch mm-hmm. a head start on where the vulnerability
that's really
lies.
Cool. Yeah, that's really cool.
And the results were pretty impressive. Like they're able to get it down to like 10% of all the diffed functions, like
yeah.
with really, really high accuracy. The function that has the vulnerability is within this top 10%,
yeah.
which saves you, you know,
90%
of yeah. time. So definitely lots of good applications for this across security. And it's nice to have a tool that automatically does it.
Yeah, that's legit. You want to tell us about this gift card research?
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, so our boy W2W, a member of the Full-Time Hunters Guild, by the way, shout out to my man. Dropped some research called gift card security research. And I just wanted to shout this one out. We'll link it in the description as always, but let me go ahead and share my screen as well for those folks on YouTube. This research was awesome because once again, it's just a time when somebody says, hey, I'm going to research this specific vuln class or this specific niche. Mm-hmm. And they do it across a lot of targets and they record the results. I'm such a sucker for that stuff, man.
You
that's
really
what
are.
That's the stuff that freaking Bug Bounty Reports explained does on their like premium newsletter subscription, where you'll just get like these super data rich analyses on types of vulnerabilities. And it's just so insightful into the way that you should look at these vulnerable classes.
Yeah. And so, you apply it sometimes in your own life, like with the credit card research. So,
100%. Yeah. Yep. And it's very applicable and definitely worth whatever I pay for Bug Bounty Reports Explained premium for sure. Yeah. But this one W2W gives us for free. And he says, I acquired 30 plus gift cards on this research and revealed 9 vulnerabilities by unlocking new features, which granted me $6,500. And let me see how many bugs he's got here. I think 9 different bugs. And there were 3 primary vuln classes that popped out of this. There was race condition, there was HTML injection or XSS, and IDOR. Yeah. And I just wanted to echo this as well, because my personal experience has really aligned with this research that anytime I've bought gift cards, there's either a race condition or an IDOR. I don't know what it is, but it just always is.
Every time.
And so I think that's a pretty target rich and attack vector rich environment. And you can sometimes get a gift card for like $5. So it's definitely worth the investment.
Yeah. I mean, anytime you can get access to like a little more scope, a few more API calls and like working ones too, right? If you have the gift card, you're actually gonna be able to actually purchase something. You'll be able to actually enable it. It gives you access to a bunch of like either new domains or new paths that are actually working for you.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And then, so, you know, those are the 3 main vuln types that he found the specific research. And then I wanted to also just shout out this last tip at the very end. He doesn't talk about this too much in the actual article, but he says at the end, final thoughts, he says, ensure you enable out of scope logging and all MIME types in your MIDM proxy to catch the checkout finalization request. I wasted quite a few gift cards to learn this lesson. It doesn't hurt when it's a $5 gift card, but it's a big ouch moment when it's a $50 gift card.
Yeah.
I totally agree. Like going through that full process and just literally intercepting everything and going through each request being like, is this the final request? Is this the final request? Yeah. You know, so that you can race condition it or something like that. Very important. And there's definitely some gotchas there with the proxies trying to let you focus on specific stuff.
Yeah. And I would say a lot of these companies that are using gift cards might be using third parties. So it's very smart to enable out of scope logging, because it could be on the weird domain. It could be on the third party domain. Like you don't want to miss it.
Very common. That's one of the things I love about Kaido. It's a little bit of a love and hate thing with that with Kaido right now, but Kaido doesn't have currently a way to set logging to none for stuff.
You can't just drop requests. They get stored.
Right. They always get stored, and you know, that blows up your hard drive space a little bit, but storage is cheap. And you know what is not cheap? Not having the piece of information that you need. So there have been many times where I've been like, oh, dude, that S3 bucket, or like, oh man, this functionality is getting pushed out to a third party. How did I do that? And then I went back and the data was there.
Right.
And I was like, frick yeah. So, I mean, that alone has made me several thousand dollars, I think, you know, just having that force me to be a little bit more permissive with what I'm storing. And that's the same sort of thing we talked about last year when mayonnaise came on the pod, where he literally has never not had every single, he's never gotten rid of any piece of data related to a bug bounty target ever. Right. And he's just got it all in a big database, and he just does big data queries against it, you know, and he just uncovers these trends across targets and across the same target. So definitely a useful piece of functionality, I think.
For sure. Yeah. And then I think the one last thing we wanted to mention, it's on your list, but I can kick us off on it.
Yeah.
Is that the top 10 voting from PortSwigger.
Oh yeah.
Is now out. And not only is it a huge treasure trove of data, but our listeners probably care deeply about who wins, because there's a lot of our listeners who are on this list, right? And so
there are.
Make sure you go out and support your fellow hackers by voting for their research if you like it. And it's a fantastic way to go back and learn what you missed or see what you missed from as far as like cool hacks go from last year.
Absolutely. Yeah, there are a lot of CTBB podcast guests that have their data out here in this up for rating. So that's pretty rad. Definitely, like you said, a good place to see the research that you missed, great research that you missed, but also just to support the fellow hacker.
I can't help but ask you, do you have any idea why there's one that says do not vote for the century?
Dude, I saw that. I just saw that as I'm scrolling through there. I don't know, but dude, you know that's going to get so many freaking votes.
For sure. It's going to get so many votes.
Don't do that, guys. Come on. Don't waste your vote. Give some valid research the vote, please.
That's true.
Solid. All right, man.
Cool.
So now the time has come to talk about web headers.
Yeah, ready for topic, this? The topic I did not know where we were even discussing today. So yes, I will play the ignorant listener, and also in general, you know, my specialty is not in front end stuff. It's definitely been server side bugs and kind of big fuzzing, and then obviously AI of late. So this is stuff that I've been wanting to dig into, and this has given me an excuse to learn about it. So when I don't understand something, a lot of listeners probably don't either, and so I'll be sure to ask that.
Yeah, dude, ask away and I'll do my best to articulate it all. So yeah, what we're talking about today is cross-origin headers, which is a suite of headers, cross-origin opener policy, cross-origin embedder policy, cross-origin research policy, resource policy, and how these specific headers apply to the browser and how to get around them. And unfortunately, I have to say, guys, It's rough. It's rough out there. There's not a lot of ways to get around these things. But I'm going to give you my best takes on it. And we have a little bit of research from the Critical Research Lab, which is the team that we kind of put together to try to give us cool pieces of information about this. And also I'll just kind of, you know, talk to you about how these headers are actually used.
Yeah. So question with this Andrew Locke link at the top, I think you're going to talk about, did you learn anything new? Like, did you learn any kind of potential bypasses or gadgets as you went through this?
Yeah. So I think the Andrew Locke article is really, which we'll link in the description, but also just go ahead and share on the screen now. It's sort of like a three-part blog post on these cross-origin headers. Mm-hmm. It's entitled Understanding Cross-Origin Security Headers. So he does part one on Coop, which is the main culprit, the one that we hate. Yeah. And then there's part two on cross-origin resource policy, which is an interesting one. And then we've got cross-origin embedder policy as well. So these are definitely, if you're looking to sort of skill up on this area, these are great. I think this came out in November of last year. But yeah, there was definitely some things that I learned about here that I didn't know before. So definitely worth a read if you're trying to skill up there. But I'll also try to give you the TLDR today.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
And see how we can do that. So first, this whole set of headers and this whole concept is related to a browser concept called cross-origin isolation. Mm-hmm. And this is a concept that was recently put into the browsers to kind of help deal with the Spectre attacks that were happening that allowed you to violate same origin policy. And if you opt into these cross-origin headers, you get some of the features back that they had to remove to help deal with the Spectre attacks. And there's a JavaScript window property called cross-origin isolated, and it's a Boolean, true or false, and it tells us whether in this specific context is this frame, this window, is it cross-origin isolated or not? So that's something that I didn't even know existed, but is actually in place.
What are some examples for why you would want to not isolate an origin, or why, and then when you would?
Yeah. So if you're trying to isolate an origin, it provides an extra layer of security, but also there are reasons to not do it, right? If you need to communicate with a different tab, via like a window.opener relationship or something like that, via post message or whatever, then you can't really isolate yourself because there has to be a relationship between those two tabs in the browser context group.
If an app were to open a new window for you to like log in or do an auth flow or do something, and then it needs to pass something back to the first tab, they could not use this feature.
Exactly. And that's something you often see with auth flows is you're handing it off either to a third party or to a something on your same site, right? Which is like, auth.domain.com going back to www.domain.com, right? The site is the same, but the origin is different, where it starts to get a little tricky. And so the main header that just really tweaks my melon, Joseph, they really just hex up some great exploits is the cross-origin opener policy, or COOP, okay?
Yep.
So let me rant on this one for a second, okay? COOP, this son of a badger, is really messing up some stuff. Because what often happens when we're trying to exploit post-message related bugs, which is like one of my bread and butter vulnerabilities, is we need to open up a new tab because of same site stuff or X-frame options, right? So we pop open a new tab and then we send a post message from our attacker controlled page to our victim page, right? And in order for us to send, they have to be in the same browser context group, which is why we open it up and we get a frame reference. And then we can do frame reference.post message, and that's how we send it. This son of a gun, Coop here, severs that frame reference. So whenever I pop open a new tab, if that new tab, you know, site.com,
sure,
has the coop header and it says coop same origin or same origin allow pop-ups, then when I try to access that window, you know, that I opened up via window.open, it's going to say null. It severs that relationship, right?
Yeah.
So there's no freaking way, Joseph, to send a post message to that page. And I have a zero.
How many bugs
right
do you
now.
Have that are blocked by that?
Dude, I actually figured out a way around it, which I'll explain, which is great. But this will really, really inhibit a lot of post message related bugs. And but there is an upside to this too, dude, which is that you can tell companies that don't want to pay for like third party library vulnerabilities, like that have post message, that they have a remediation method, which is they can put cross origin opener policy on their page. And then there's no way to send a post message through, right? Yeah. And so it's sort of a double-edged sword, right?
You can use it to people paid sometimes because you can,
Yeah, because they have a mitigation.
You can give
right?
a fix, yeah.
Exactly. So that it's a little bit of a double-edged sword in that regard. But essentially what it does is it severs the relationship between your attacker page and the victim page. Mm-hmm. And there's no way to communicate via post message between those two. Now, let me kind of talk about the nuances of this bad boy for a second, okay? So one, and this is the big one, it only affects top level pages. Okay. So if you can, so let's say you've got a vulnerability on www.site.com, right?
Yeah.
If you can get www.site.com iframed into a page that does not have coup headers, right? So let's say, you know, iframe.site.com, iframes sure. in www.site.com, right? Right. If iframe.site.com does not have a coup header, then you can do a window.open to iframe.site.com, and then it will iframe www.site.com, and then you can send a message from your attacker-controlled page through iframe.site.com
to iframe www. On the page. Yeah.
Exactly. And so even though www.site.com has the coup header, it's going to be ignored because it's not a top-level page.
Right.
And so you still will have that frame reference and can send that data through. And so here's the place where, I mean, this is the major workaround that the team, you know, the research lab team that was kind of talking about these concepts shared, which is that if you can figure out a way to get it iframed in, then that's kind of your best way to exploit this. And I'll just share from my own personal hacking experience that it is easier to get an iframe injection, when you are dealing with some third-party libraries, right? Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes what will happen is like a site will have a third-party library. It'll like iframe in some like support page or like some
makes
chat
sense.
Page or something like that, right? And then if you can get an XSS on that page, then you can
really
reach
funny.
Through, redirect. If you can get it, this is how it works. So like I'm getting crazy now, guys. Listen closely because this one's going to be tricky. Okay. So you get an XSS on the support.com, right?
Right.
And so you get the XSS on support.com. You iframe that into your attacker page, right? So now you've got control of support.com in your attacker page. Then you open up a window to the page that has the iframe to support.com.
Interesting,
right?
Yeah.
And then you reach from your attacker controlled, you iframe. Know, XSS, and you reach over through the page that you can't into the iframe on the victim page. And then you redirect that to the page that has the coup headers.
That's absurd. Right? That's even possible.
Do you see what I'm saying? And then now,
I understand.
Yeah, because you have the XSS, it's same origin, so you can do redirects. And now you've got the page that has the coup headers embedded in iframe.site.com.
Yep.
And then you can communicate to that page via post message and then pop your XSS or whatever. So nice. It's a little convoluted, but it really does work. And it's the best way that I've found to get around coup headers.
Go hack on things you're not supposed to.
Yeah, well,
go find XSS on third parties.
Leverage the third party trust relationship I prefer to call it.
There you go. Yep. And you're doing it for a responsible reason and disclosing it and it's fine. But yes, no, I agree. I think that's really cool. And I'm shocked that I was able to follow that. Hopefully the listeners can too. But yeah, basically on your attacker page, if you get XSS, you can iframe that support.com and influence the iframe of support.com on the company's website, which allows you to redirect it. Yeah.
Dude, that's great. All right, dude, I'm glad you're able to track with that. I don't know if that's you being big brain or my explanation being sufficient, but some combination of the two, I imagine.
Good. Yeah, yeah. Makes sense.
Okay, so let me mention this other piece of this, okay?
Yep.
Coop is also, it's called cross-origin opener policy, but it actually has, it affects the opener and the opened, right? So if you can get a, like, whatever site.com to open a pop-up window, it will also have a severed relationship if the coop header is in place.
Well, actually, yes. Yeah. So let's tell the listener real quick, what are the options for that header, the values?
Yeah, okay. Great. Thank you. Great.
Let's start there. Yeah.
Great specification there. Okay, so there are three values for that. There's same origin, which means only sites of the same origin can have that opener relationship, right? Okay. There's same origin allows pop-ups, which I'll explain, and then there's unsafe none or missing, which is like the default value when it's not there. Okay?
So that's good if same it's origins. That's great if it's missing. Yeah.
Exactly. So same origin allow pop-ups is the nuanced one, okay? So essentially what happens with that one is like you can't have any relationship. Excuse me. You can't have any relationship with the page beforehand. But if that page opens up a pop-up to like your attacker controlled page, then that page will have a reference to the other the page with the coup headers because it's a pop-up from the page with the coup headers. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you can get it to pop up a window, then you will be able to access that, get a frame reference to that window via window.opener. Okay. So that's another sort of workaround. It's a little bit more rare for you to be able to get a pop-up like that. You kind of need like a pop-up injection, or maybe there's like some page where they forgot to do like, where they had like like an href, you know, pointing to it, and they didn't put like no refer or anything like that. But if you can get that to happen, then you can be able to trigger the attack back on that same page that has the coup headers. Yeah. Does that make sense? Or
It does a little bit. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I've never even heard of pop-up injection. So
there's a good reason for that which is I just invented it on the spot. But controlling where, you know, what window or what location a specific open. Site is popping up.
Yeah. It seems pretty rare, like you said.
I've never seen same site allow pop-ups, so it's not really a very relevant situation. But I figured I would add that nuance in there just in case.
Cool.
Okay. So that's coop, pain in the ass, severs the frame relationship. Solution is if it has allow pop-ups, try to get a pop-up. And if it doesn't have allow pop-ups, if it's just same origin, then you need to get that page iframed into a page that is same origin, but does not have the coop header, which is tricky, you know? So you got to understand where your application segments are and get that iframe injection. And I'll just add there is no same site setting for this. So it has to be exactly same origin. And so my example was a little bit flawed. It can't be iframe.site.com. It has to be www.site.com, iframing in www.site.com, which does make it more difficult, but was the situation when I actually exploited it.
That's
cool. And so just so understand.
Large companies with a lot of functionality under a main domain is where you would have to find that.
Yeah, exactly. And there will be different application segments as well, right? Where there's slash whatever. Right. Is one app and then slash blah, blah, blah is another app, right?
That's right.
So that's the sort of situation we're looking at. Okay, so two more headers to go. These would be a lot less nuanced. We have cross-origin embedder policy. Okay, this one is kind of exactly what it sounds like. It's a policy on what can be embedded into the page. Okay, so the default value for that is unsafe none, or if it's missing, then that's unsafe none. And there's two other values, require corp, which I'll explain in just a second, and then credential list, which is any resource that you have embedded in the page will be sent with zero cookies, you know, your images, whatever. And this is a little bit less of a big thing now that we've got same site cookies, that cookies aren't really sent anyway, unless they are, you know, top level navigations.
Yeah.
But if this is something that you're running into and you do need to have those on there, then you're kind of screwed. So just be aware of those three values. And then going back to the other one,
What does require corp do?
Good question. Let me explain that. So require corp says any asset that is being embedded in this page has to return the cross origin resource policy header. Okay. Mm. And if it doesn't, then it's blocked. Okay. And the cross-origin resource policy header, unlike these other two headers, embedder policy and opener policy, which are embedded on the page, this resource policy header has to be embedded on the asset that is being loaded.
Okay? That's really interesting. I feel like this is a kind of a paradigm that could be applied at like a meta paradigm that could be applied for security in other places. It makes me think it's like a really neat concept that you want to like go ahead and pre-approve or put on an allow list things from other places. And so what you do is you put it in the body or the header of the thing that's coming in. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's very thorough. It's very depends in depth. I just DM'd you a link. This is like to Google usercontent.com, which is where they like host user content for Google. And you notice there their cross-origin resource policy says cross-origin, which is the most permissive setting, right? So there's three settings: same site, same origin, and cross-origin. So this is particularly helpful if you are looking to prevent an asset that you have from being embedded on an attacker-controlled page. And there's a specific class of vulnerabilities that is all but gone now, but does still sort of exist, called cross-site XSSI, cross-site script injection. Okay.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you were in the like front-end game when this class of vulnerability existed, but essentially how this works is, on an attacker-controlled page, you do a script tag and you include a dynamically generated script on the target website that leaks data about the current user's authenticated state. And then when it loads script into your page, you can do some JavaScript shit to pull out the data and get access to it, right? And so this kind of got deleted when same site lax became the default. But if the auth is being done off of same site none cookies and the script is being dynamically generated off those cookies, then it could be something that could still happen. So, you know, anytime you see dynamically generated scripts, you should be thinking about that.
Yeah.
But this is the cross-origin resource policy is a great way to prevent this from happening. So you can take that script, add the cross-origin resource policy header to it and say, hey, cross-origin's set it to same site or same origin. Cross-origin is not allowed to load this resource. And then that would block that XSSI from occurring because the attacker could not include your dynamically generated script tag on their page. Does that make sense?
Does the browser just like straight up refuse it?
Yeah. It says, no, we're not going to let them load this resource because they don't have.
Yeah, that's cool.
So it's pretty solid.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you implement all three of those headers correctly, then the JavaScript Boolean cross-origin isolated will be set to true. And then you get access to a bunch of like super secure timing APIs and stuff like that that you can get access to that Spectre was utilizing to leak a bunch of stuff. So I just wanted to give those to the listeners and kind of say, hey, this is kind of what we've got as far as these cross-origin headers go. Like cross-origin embedder policy and cross-origin resource policy are not super helpful for an attacker, but understanding the nuances of COOP are absolutely necessary. And I think that workaround that the research lab came up with like getting it embedded into a page is super helpful for exploiting these sort of scenarios.
Yeah. I mean, I doubt there are very many people who have figured that out. And so there's probably a lot of those lying around where it seemed unexploitable, but there actually is now a path to exploitation.
Yeah. Yeah. So shout out to the team. It warms the heart a little bit to see some good research coming out of the research lab already. It is an investment we're doing, and we've already seen, I think, several vulns get popped from the research lab, and then also this nice piece of research getting pumped out to the pod. So appreciate you guys on the research lab.
100%.
Okay, dude, hang in there. I got two more headers I want to tell you about.
Perfect.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So these are not related to cross-origin stuff, but I just kind of wanted to, since we're talking about web headers, I kind of wanted to like throw these in there just as a bonus. Okay. The next two are service worker allowed and X content type options. Okay.
So yeah, I'm glad you have service worker allowed on there. I know you have mentioned service worker stuff a lot in the past, and I'm not, you know, super up to date on like how it works and like what vulns are possible there, but you see it all over the place these days. So I'm curious. What you have to say about this?
So service workers, for those of you that aren't familiar, is essentially a way for you to, I'm going to explain this from such an attacker perspective. Like literally what I was about to say was a way for you to gain persistence in the browser, right? Service workers are not that. Service workers are something to help with caching and like a bunch of other stuff like that in the browser. But from an attacker perspective, from a hacker's perspective, it's a way for you to gain persistence in a victim's browser, okay? So the way this typically works is you have to have file upload. You have to be able to upload a JS file, and you've got to be able to upload an HTML file or have an XSS, okay?
Cool.
And once you do that, you can register a service worker, and that service worker is scoped to whatever path you have the JS file and the XSS on. So if you're, you know, if your JS file is under, you know, /site/asset/upload, then your service worker is only going to be able to access /site/asset/upload and affect the pages that are being loaded in the victim's browser thereafter at those paths. Okay.
Yep. Yep.
But it's pretty cool. If you can get it installed at slash, then you just essentially have persistent XSS on every single page in the browser, which is
awesome. Yeah, I was going to say, I guess that means that many service workers are probably implemented at root because they need to be able to run across a majority of the website.
Yeah. So if you're able to attack a service worker, that's a really interesting scope too, because if you're able to hijack, then I imagine there's a lot of stuff you can do there. I do know that it's a little bit tricky, and I do know that the research lab is doing some research on that right now. But very, very ripe scope. However, so you know, that path thing really kind of gets to become a problem, because it's not that rare that we can upload like a JavaScript file or an HTML file to a target, right? That's pretty standard. But you know, it's normally at some like obscure path that has our ID in it. If we register a service worker there, then it doesn't really do anything.
Right.
And so there's this header that's very interesting called service worker allowed. And it's an HTTP response header that contains a path that the service worker should be scoped to. So even if your JS file is at like, you know, /asset/user/myuserid/whatever.js, if you can figure out a way to return the service worker allowed header and say service worker allowed :// right, then it will...
The browser just trusts it?
It trusts it, and it will give the service worker permission to access anything under slash.
Cool.
Right? Which is great. So here's where the rubber meets the road on this one. I just want to make people aware of this because I know Franz has done a lot of really cool stuff in Matan as well, related to using service workers to leak like private, like signed header or signed like query parameters to access like a specific file and that sort of thing. And I think this is really helpful for those sort of scenarios, but it's pretty rare that you can control an HTTP response header. And there's two sort of main configurations where I can think that would be happening. And that is with CRLF injection, right? Yep. If you can get a CRLF injection, then you can insert this header and get the XSS and generate the JS file, which is pretty rad. Or more likely in a scenario where the app allows you to configure a reverse proxy back to your own site. Okay. And I wanted to sort of shout out this specific functionality in Shopify called app proxies. And essentially it allows you to do just that, proxy a specific path on a store that you've installed an application on back to your website. And so, you know, typically you could return the service worker allowed header, and that would allow you to register a service worker, which would gain you control of the whole My Shopify website. But they have a list of disallowed headers that can come through this reverse proxy, and service worker allowed is on that. So if anybody can figure out a way to smuggle a service worker allowed header through this app proxy, then that's a really cool piece of scope. And any other scenarios, any other targets where there's like an app proxy like functionality where you're doing a reverse proxy, there is a really ripe attack scenario there with service workers being able to take over that whole origin, not just the origin that you're scoped to for the reverse proxy.
So why does Shopify have this? If you don't want to ask
Dude, I don't know, man. I'll give a full disclaimer, you know.
Dynamic?
I would be careful reporting bugs on this scope, you know. I know that there are some weird quirks with this specific piece of scope, but I just wanted to use it as an example because it's pretty funky functionality. And I think there's a lot of areas where that can cause problems.
Yeah. I was just trying to think through, like, if I understood why Shopify added it, then I would be able to like kind of update my mental model for what other companies, what other programs would maybe have a similar functionality.
Yeah. I think, you know, Shopify is really built on plugins. So I think you see this type of functionality in any area where, you know, there's app hosting or there's like third-party plugins that really need to be seamlessly integrated into the main app. Those sort of scenarios are where you
maybe Atlassian, stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Atlassian might have something similar. I want to say I saw something on those giant apps, you know, often have this functionality sort of buried in there related to the app functionality.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, cool. Last one. Dude, my throat is getting a little scratchy again. I don't know. I've had this cold for like a week. It just won't go away.
Yeah, I heard it come through once or twice, but you've been good.
Yeah. All right. So last one here, X Content Options has one available sort of parameter that you can give it, which is no sniff. Okay. And have you heard of this one before, Joseph? Do you know what this one does?
I don't, but I have seen it many, many times.
Yes. So essentially what it does is the browser will attempt to sniff the content type of the page that is being returned if a content type header is not provided. Okay. And so this one says, don't freaking do that is what it says, right? Because that a lot of XSSs can occur from that sort of thing. Content type sniffing, or even as we've learned recently, character set sniffing can cause a lot of issues. So this says, don't do that. Just don't. Okay. And I just wanted to tell the community about this one little nuance that I stumbled upon not too long ago, which is that if you repeat the content type options header twice, let's say you've got a CRLF injection and your injection is below the content type options header and below the content type header, right? So you can't overwrite those two headers. What you can do is you can add another X content types header with a invalid value, and the browser will be like, ah, dude, there's two content type options headers. What do I do? I'm gonna sniff. I gotta sniff. You know, the browser is just really eager to sniff for some reason. And so if you provide two of these content type options headers, it will actually discard both of them. Wow. And allow the browser to actually sniff the content type from the data that's being returned. So it's a pretty nuanced scenario.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, man. So this content type options header, it's really funky.
Why in the world, why would a browser just drop it if there's two? It's like, just take one at least.
That's what they do for most other headers. But I think this is also a really like interesting area of research where this one content type options header behaves this way. I wonder if there's any other headers that sort of have a similar functionality.
Yeah.
So that's something that's on the research list for the research lab, and maybe the community can kind of poke at it as well.
Yeah, it's so easy to now, I think you mentioned this to me recently, to have AI spin up like little Docker containers of things that like, you know, servers that respond in weird ways, for example. It'd be really interesting to like have it do that with a bunch of different duplicate headers and see how browsers respond.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a cool and really easily done piece of research. I think like that could easily be knocked out in 8 hours and you could like write something up and it'd be really
and
value
you could
add
feature
to the
on
community.
The podcast. It'd be great. People. Yeah. Let us know.
Yeah, send it to us, guys. Drop it in the cool research section if you do it, and we'll cover it on the pod. One little thing that I just wanted to close with. Dude, so you've seen the refer header, right? That's like super common.
Of course, a million times, yeah.
Dude, I've always thought there was something funky about the refer header. Like I sometimes, you know, there's like CSER protections or whatever, and you're like checking something, and it says, oh, you know, don't have the refer header. And then I type refer, and I give it a refer, and it says, don't have the refer header. And I'm like, I misspelled referrer. You know, there's only one R.
Right.
No, there's two R's, dude. Refer the referrer header that is always sent in the browser every time you make a request contains a misspelling of the word referrer. Referrer is spelled R-E-F-E-R-R-E-R.
That's
and
right.
The one that the browser actually sends is R-E-F-E-R-E-R.
Yeah, so, I don't know. I came across this randomly. Someone else mentioned it as like a little tidbit or like, did you know about web security like a few years ago? But it's really funny and mind blowing. I love like any kind of little quirks of old systems. I think about that a lot with video games. I know a lot of our listeners probably game, but I think it's really like just neat and a really cool byproduct of the fact that some small dev team made some decision 15 years ago and now like, 2 million people are like playing this game where they're over optimizing to find that one item that the developer didn't think about when they actually added an attribute that was overpowered or something, you know, like I think it's really cool to have those downstream effects. And it feels similar here. It's like some developer misspelled it, and at some point it was way too embedded in all the systems to like roll back.
Yeah. So it makes me feel good. Like, you know, these people, these core people that built the whole, and this is what I'm talking about. Like when I said on the pod a couple of weeks ago, like the people that built all these crazy specs and these cool, like crazy protocols and stuff like that, they're just humans, just like you and me. You know, like there's no need to be so intimidated from all of this. If some bro in his basement built this protocol, you can figure it out in like, you know, 10 times as much time as he took. So it's not going to be beyond your grasp. You're not incapable of learning this. You can, it just takes time. So, and people like those bros misspell the word referrer, and then the whole internet has to use this misspelling for the rest of the time the internet exists. So
yeah, I feel like usually the stuff that's like hard to understand or confusing is mostly due to like naming conventions or like the fact that our brains kind of conflate two topics or two subjects.
Yeah.
So as soon as you like can properly classify it, even as you were describing that thing that I grokked the first time with the Windows and all that, I feel like having like just a physical mental view of what actually is occurring. I even noticed you kind of do it when you draw it out with your hands and you say it goes over and then it goes down, it goes
in. Yeah, exactly.
It's like these like spatial references really help understand front end hacks, like front end bugs. Yeah. So
For sure, dude. Yeah. And that's why we try to always draw it out when we're doing the masterclasses in the Critical Thinkers Discord and stuff like that, to try to give people a tangible method. You know, you got auditory learners, you got visual learners, you got kinesthetic learners. I think we over leverage, you know, on the kinesthetic learners, because we're hackers, we like to get our hands on the keyboard and tweak with stuff. But there's a lot of people that learn via audio, the podcast, or visual, you know, watching something or seeing a graph drawn. You just got to figure out which way you learn best and then try to get the content into that medium for you, which is why we also release the podcast via text with the hacker notes. So people that learn better by reading can ingest the same content and get the value out. So
yeah, exactly. And you know, using AI, you can kind of swap between those modalities a little bit more seamlessly these days. So
yeah, for sure, man. All right. You got anything else to add, or is that a wrap on the pod?
No, I think that's it. I appreciate it. I'm excited. Gonna go try to find my first bug on day one of full-time bug bounty. So,
dude, GG, go get it, man. All right. Thanks. Peace.
See ya.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want more Critical Thinking content, head over to ctbb.show/discord. Join the Discord. There's lots of great conversations and chats going on over there. And if you want to support the show, there's the Discord subscriber tiers, which give you access to masterclasses, AMAs, hackalongs, exclusive scripts, and an exclusive chat channel with us. We'll see you there.